Shit, I think you're listening to Frank Prattle.
Tonight you're mine, completely. You give your love so sweetly. Tonight the light of love is in your eyes. But will you love me tomorrow?
My name is Zephyr Thrall. You're listening to Frank Prattle here at Art International Radio at artonair.org, or maybe you're listening at frankprattle.com. Today, glorious day outside. New York City is finally pulling out of the slump that it's been in for roughly 6 months, where it's pissing, madness, rain, snow, sleet, the works. I'm here today down in St. James Place with James Fuentes of James Fuentes LLC. Hi, how are you doing?
Good, how are you?
I'm just dandy. So maybe you can just start out by telling us a little bit about who you are and what it is that you do.
Sure. So my name is James Fuentes, and currently I'm the owner of James Fuentes LLC. We're a contemporary art gallery based in Lower Manhattan on 35 St. James Place. We've been here for a little over 2 years in a really interesting building. It's a two-story building, and I live on the second floor, and the gallery is below my apartment, so I live above the shop. The history of this space was that it was an Italian social club for a little over 62 years. That was the previous tenant. And another interesting fact is that my early years, the early part of my youth, I grew up on Madison Street, which is the corner street. We're on Madison Street in St. James Place. I grew up in the Vladix housing projects, and my parents both came here from Ecuador in the mid-1960s and lived a very kind of classic immigrant life in the Lower East Side. And then when I was around 11 years old, we moved up to the South Bronx. They now live in the Northern Bronx, which it seems like every 10, 15 years they try to get as far away from the Lower East Side as possible. So that's my connection to this neighborhood, and this is what I'm doing at currently.
Sounds good. So maybe they'll try Jersey next, who knows? Tell me a little bit about how you got started in the gallery world. I know that you've worked for galleries before, like Lombard Fried, also Deitch Projects and things like that. What started that? What was kind of the crack of the bat for you?
Okay, so when I was in high school in the Bronx, I went to an all-boys Catholic high school called Mount St. Michael Academy. And pretty typical Catholic high school. Our real claim to fame is that Puff Daddy or Sean Combs went to high school there. There wasn't really an emphasis on art or music or anything of the sort at the time. But from a pretty young age, I became interested in subcultures. I say my first sort of community was this BMX community. When I was really young, I'd ride my bicycle around, and I was part of this sort of BMX and skater community, which surprisingly, even in the South Bronx, when I lived in the South Bronx, there was like a pretty large community and stuff. And so I think that and my interest in music, politically oriented music, even like The Clash when I was very young, those were the seeds for my disposition towards art and culture and poetry. And so I went to this high school. I spent all 4 years basically just dreaming about the day that I got out. And that led me to go to Bard College in upstate New York, which is a pretty extreme sort of different environment than my high school was. And
I'd say it's just about the exact opposite, it sounds like.
Yeah, definitely. I would say most of my peers in high school have become cops or firefighters or civil servants or a lot of blue collar jobs. My peers from Bard have had different trajectories. Everything from a good friend of mine who's a vortex healer. Another friend of mine's an urban planner.
What is a vortex healer?
That's where you heal without that's like this energy healing. So you sort of you don't have to touch someone, but it's like this therapy kind of thing. My friend Willa Bepler is an energy healer, and apparently she was even able to consult someone over the phone and do her energy healing over the phone.
Have you done it yet?
I haven't done it yet, I mentioned the variety of things that people did from my high school and from my college, just to give a sense of maybe the different worlds that I feel like I come from and that I feel very much a part of. And while I was at Bard College, there was a program there, one of the first in America, called the Center for Curatorial Studies. It was a graduate program, but the Mary Louise Hessel Library at the center, and Mary Louise Hessel is a great collector who founded the program. While I was there, even though there was a graduate program, the Center for Curatorial Studies had a very open door policy to undergraduate students. And I was studying filmmaking and anthropology at Bard, and but towards the end of my time there, I practically lived at the library at the Center for Curatorial Studies. So I almost feel like by default, I got my education there. And after graduating college, I was going to continue pursuing making my experimental films. And so I rented a storefront on Broome Street in Varick. And it was this little shoebox space, 300 square feet. Actually, my current gallery is only 100 square feet bigger. But I rented this space, and my intention was to make my films and to live in the back. And no later than like a day or two into living there, people kept knocking on the door, and they were asking for Gavin Brown's Enterprise. And it turned out that this like tiny little space had been a really important gallery before I moved in. This was September of 1998, and so I looked into it, and I actually went up to 15th Street to where the gallery had relocated, and they were all very, very cool, and I just saw some of the most amazing art there, and I was like, well, wow, this little space was a gallery before, maybe I'll just put up a show to help pay the rent, and that was my intention. In October of 1998, I put up an exhibition, invited three college friends who were photographers to do a show, and what ended up happening was, so I realized that these artists, let me say that this space, when I realized that it had been an important gallery, it instantly changed my notion of what a gallery space should look like.
Right.
It was this little storefront, and for me, it instantly also democratized the concept of having a gallery, and so that was a pretty incredible moment for me. And so I invited three of my friends to put on a show. I had nothing to offer them except for this space and this umbrella, you know, like, let's call it a gallery, you know. And on my invitation, I didn't even have a telephone number at the time. I included my beeper number. So if you wanted to see the show, you had to page me. And despite the fact that I had nothing to offer, these artists, like, really rose to the occasion. They were blown away that they had an opportunity to show work, and they made work that they would have never produced unless I had invited them to show it. And so that part of it was extremely fulfilling. And then once we started, once the opening started and people started, you know, people came out and were so supportive, and there was like this occasion for a community to get together. I really loved that part of it too. You know, so it was like the fulfillment of like being a catalyst for new artworks and this whole dialogue with the public. And I also felt really proud about what the show looked like. So I felt like I was really good at it. So from like kind of by accident that day that show opened, it was called Three Photographers, and it included Aaron Diskin, Jonathan Chick, and Nicholas Zinner. And Nicholas Zinner has gone on to be a rock star. He's in a band called the Yeah Yeah Yeahs. Ever since that day, I realized, like, you know, I think this is my career. And so I fell into this career by accident a little over 10 years ago.
And so you've definitely gone through twists and turns, having left Broome Street long ago and moved all over the place. And now you find yourself here at St. James. But before that, you worked as a gallery director. And what's that like, you know, kind of working under someone else's vision, like, say, Lombard Fried that you worked for?
Yeah, well, you know, the journey ever since that initial moment, the spark, you know, that first opening has been intense. You know, it's been a roller coaster. I feel like I've been chewed up and spit out several times by this field. I've gone through many moments where I wondered whether or not I had a future in this field and stuff. And I felt very proud this last October because I'd reached the 10-year threshold. And I feel, I definitely feel like now more than ever that I do, there is potential for longevity for me in this. You know, the whole working for other people and figuring it out, it was a pretty gnarly experience. So after about 2.5 years at my first gallery, I closed because I didn't know what I was doing. You know, I didn't even know what a press release was. And I kind of floated around for a little while, and it was an independent curator for a bit, and curated an exhibition by a friend who had recently gone to prison for forging Basquiat, named Alfredo Martinez. And I was just doing, like...
He actually went to prison for it?
Yeah. He went to jail for forging not only the Basquiat, these Basquiat paintings, but also their accompanying certificates of authenticity. And we had curated an exhibition, you know, one of, like, in that period in between gallery directorships and closing my own gallery, I basically took any opportunity I could to curate exhibitions at these random spaces and just, like, I felt like that was also a very amazing time for me because I was almost going through withdrawal from like being able to exercise that muscle, that creative muscle. I dreamed quite a bit during those years and like was conjuring up like, what would I do if I reopened a gallery? Like, and probably quite a few of the ideas that I incorporate into my program now, like a lot of them probably have the like probably were conjured up then. So after closing, I floated around for a couple years, and one of the exhibitions I did was in a pop-up gallery space in Williamsburg that had actually been an annex to Deitch Projects. And right after 9/11, Deitch Projects is a pretty significant, like, or important gallery in New York. They had set up this Williamsburg gallery as like an annex space, but after 9/11 decided that they didn't want to pay for it. So I saw that as an opportunity, along with two friends of mine, Tim Ronan and Alfredo Martinez, to take over the lease, which was back then was already cheap, but especially after 9/11 was significantly cheaper. And so we curated a show there and called the space Entropy. And Alfredo Martinez had borrowed a couple of paintings by Jean-Michel Basquiat for this show. And without us knowing, he had sold these works, but like sold copies of them and copies of the certificates of authenticity. And he went to jail in June of 2002.
Who sent him to jail, though?
As soon as he got the money for it, we all noticed something was definitely up, because he went on a shopping spree. You know, he didn't inform us about any of this, but like he all of a sudden had a lot of money. You know, and I imagine there was probably quite a bit of like cowboy stuff like this happening after September 11th. You know, like he basically just was able to convince this pretty prominent collector of Basquiat's work and dealer of Basquiat's work to buy it. And so after he transacted, basically this client, I think, started calling around and seeing if maybe somebody else was interested, because I think he was flipping it, you know, he was reselling it. And as soon as he figured out that it wasn't real, he contacted the FBI, and then the FBI set up this whole sting operation, pretended to be collectors, and managed to get Alfredo to sell them new Basquiat's, and what, you know, apparently it's next to impossible to prove forgery. So you have to get what they get you on is wire and mail fraud. So he sent a FedEx, and he sent an email related to this.
Oh, never the FedEx.
Yeah, wire and mail fraud. So he went to jail for 2 or 3 years for wire and mail fraud. I was pissed at him, to be honest, because I trusted the guy, and he on a couple of occasions, because he doesn't have a social security card or a passport or ID or anything, suggested that we open up a bank account together and stuff, and I never did it, and I'm so glad that I didn't, you know. But I was kind of pissed, you know. I was like, he could have easily implicated me in this whole thing, and like I might have even gone to jail myself had I been involved, you know. Like, so I, you know,
you can tell me, you were actually the one who painted the Basquiat's, weren't you?
No, I wasn't. But you know, the whole thing, like, you know, when I talk about these moments where I felt like I was chewed up and spit out, you know, like that, like, you know, the space in Williamsburg faltered, you know, we couldn't keep it going. Obviously one of the three partners was like off forging Basquiat's and stuff. Like, you know, like you sort of have to get burned by collaborators to really suss out and figure out and learn things like, character judgment and stuff like that, you know. But so
how would you judge people? I mean, like, these lessons that you've learned, what, when you are talking to a collector or a future collaborator or something, what is some of the things that you look for now in people? What are the, you know, the lessons that you've learned?
Well, that's a really good question. I think it's just become a little more intuitive than quantitative, you know. I basically just kind of get a feeling now from when I meet people, and probably determine pretty quickly whether or not I feel like this or that person is trustworthy. And then further to that, you know, you actually just kind of try to temper your actions in anticipation or with the mindset that no one is trustworthy, you know, especially in business. And so you take measures to really kind of protect yourself as much as possible, you know, in the consignments that you make with artists and the agreements that you make with clients. Like, you know, there's way, you know, you can be the most trustworthy person in the world, but you know, you can still screw somebody. So you know, and that was the useful thing about working for these more legitimate galleries, was that's where I felt like I trained and learned bureaucracy and protocol and how agreements go, and so there was like a period of a few years where I was just like, it was really like the equivalent of street art, what I was doing as a curator, you know, where I was just kind of hustling and just kind of inventing stuff and doing all these things. And then to go into this period of 4 years or so where I worked for galleries and was really by the book, was a really kind of interesting, but you know, really different experience from just kind of doing it myself, you know. But I realized that I needed that, you know. So I feel like the first couple years of my first failed gallery, and then the 2 or 3 years of like just being out there on my own, I feel like that's when I really figured out my creative voice. But I realized that what I didn't have to support it was patrons, was just this know-how, how to like get the word out there, marketing, client relations, all these very practical things. And so that's when I decided to work for other people. And you know, it's interesting because I decided to do that, and I was like, I'll spend the next 3 to 5 years like training, basically. And my whole intention the whole time was to learn and figure out how to recreate something that was so easy. Like the very first day, I fell into it by accident, but it was like 5 or 6 years later that I felt confident enough to do it again, you know, and to open up another gallery. But working for other galleries was great. Lombard Freed has a really interesting international program, so I was able to travel quite a bit. They sent me to China and Germany and the UK and France, and I was basically like in recruiting mode, so I got to see hundreds of artist studios and gained a lot of encyclopedic like information about talent out there. And then interestingly enough, I was fired from Lombard Freed because they couldn't afford to pay me anymore. And at the time, one of my hustles was this TV show concept that I was trying to conjure up with Jeffrey Deitch. And one of the partners, the two partners for this Williamsburg space, Jeffrey had gotten to meet, and he was supportive of this Williamsburg project because although he left the space, he was glad to see that somebody might continue doing something there. So when we would meet, he realized that one of the partners that we had, Tim Ronan, had actually directed some amazing music videos for Mos Def, and he was one of the founders of this record label called Raucous Records. And he was like, why don't we do a TV show or project or some kind of music video or something? You know, like Jeffrey Deitch has a pretty incredible knack for pulling in talent and recognizing talent and bringing them into the fold and making stuff happen. And so in 2002, we started trying to come up with a TV show concept, and eventually Tim moved to Miami, Alfredo went to jail, and while I was working at Lombard Freed, I had a phone conversation with somebody, and it turned out that this person had some TV experience, and I was like, oh, you know what, I have a TV show idea, you know, like, and I told, it just so happens, you know, it's like typical, like, New York or LA style, everybody has, like, a script in their back pocket or something, and that conversation led to this executive producer team meeting Jeffrey Deitch, and, basically, we were green-lighted for a television show within a matter of a few months. And this was while I was working at Lombard Freed. And our collaboration was going so well, mine and Jeffrey Deitch's, that he invited me to work at the gallery. And, you know, he was like, you know, why don't you come work for us? And turned out that I'd already been fired from Lombard Freed, although I was still working there for like another few weeks. So, you know, I played it like I still had a job, and I was like, all right, well, you know, like I negotiated and everything, you know, and started working for Deitch. And, you know, before I even started working there, we filmed this television show and stuff. And, that was a pretty interesting sort of side project.
It was called Art Star, yeah?
It was called Art Star, and it was a reality television show where eight artists compete for a solo show at Deitch Projects. And for me, it was kind of it was a learning curve, but also I think it was one of my ultimate projects because it combined my background in film studies at Bard with my new sort of experience in contemporary art, and it was a great experience. We made 8 one-hour episodes. It broadcasted on the Dish Network, which is only available to satellite cable subscribers. So no one really got to see it in New York because New York is a Time Warner monopoly. But that was one of the sort of things that I did under the auspices of Deitch Projects. And while I was there as a director, my role is mainly in sales, basically.
So why did you end up leaving there then?
Well, I was actually fired from there too. I think it was maybe not. It was probably a total of like a little over a year that I was working there. And the interesting thing was that at Lombard Freed and at Deitch, they probably saw something in me that they thought could maybe, you know, help bring in artists and talent and projects and ideas and stuff. But the longer I worked through the filter of somebody else's vision or program, basically all of the ideas that I was trying to introduce and all the artists I was trying to introduce were probably diluted because I felt like this is an artist that I think will fit into this program. And, you know, interestingly enough, by the end of my time at Deitch, I was approaching turning 30, and, you know, I was 4 years into working for other gallerists, and at that point, I felt like my well was dry. You know, I was totally uninspired, and obviously I was of no use to basically Deitch or even Lombard Fried, especially towards the end when my heart wasn't in it, you know. And I also think sometimes certain personalities just have difficulty working for other people, you know. And I never really realized how important it was to me to work for myself. I mean, eventually ultimately you work for somebody no matter what you do. You know, I work for my clients and for my artists, but I enjoy the independence and the freedom of like not having to answer to one person every day, you know. So I was fired from Deitch, and it was probably end of 2005. I had a lease on Canal and Allen Street, and I was a few weeks away from the end of my lease, and I realized like in a few weeks I'm gonna not only not have a job, but I'm not gonna have a place to live, and I really was at a juncture where I was like, maybe I need to find a new career. And, you know, it was an incredible soul-searching time, and I fell in love at the same time. Fell in love with...
Ah, love.
Yeah, yeah. Her name is Brandy Jones, and she actually works at Andrea Rosen Gallery. And, yeah, it was this, like, really, really intense time. And we're actually going to get married this summer.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you very much. A little over 3 years later. But basically, so I was doing a lot of soul searching at the time, and I realized that even the conventional process of getting a new apartment, you usually have to go through brokers, they have to do really intense credit checks and stuff like that. I realized I probably couldn't even get an apartment without a co-signer and stuff, and like I was just really bummed out, you know. So I was riding my bike a lot, and I realized the only way I'm going to get an apartment is by finding a for rent by owner sign and calling it up. So I did a lot extensive canvassing of Lower Manhattan looking for an apartment, basically, and I took a wrong turn down this street where the gallery is located, St. James Place. And although I grew up on Madison Street, I didn't even know the street existed. And I saw a for rent by owner sign, and it said storefront downstairs and apartment upstairs. And it was pretty fucking amazing, you know, like just looking through the storefront window. I had very intense visions of like seeing the space activated. I felt like I saw my future in this space, and I was like, man, if I get this space, like, I'm going to start a gallery, you know, like, and it was a no-brainer. As soon as I found a space, even though I had at that point resisted the idea of even staying in this field, like, I saw my future in this space, and was fortunately able to get a lease on the whole building for close to 10 years. The fact that the space is located on St. James Place, on the corner of James Street by Madison Street, where I grew up, I felt like made it especially sort of serendipitous and meaningful. You know, it's a total coincidence where we are, but I feel like our location inherently feels like it's part of the fabric of the city. So,
tell me a little bit about, you know, you had mentioned earlier when you were talking about working at Lombard Fried and at Deitch that you realized at a certain point that you couldn't follow someone else's vision, that, you know, it became apparent to you that, you know, you needed to work on your own. So what are kind of the, it's been a few years now, and what are some of the, you know, kind of the visions, if you will, or like the directions that you've come up with on your own? What are you striving for? Like, what are you fleshing out right now?
Well, I think what we've been trying to sort of advocate for is artists who maybe don't as easily fit into what's become a pretty institutionalized feeling sort of machine of the contemporary art scene. You know, of my generation, there's quite a few galleries whose rosters primarily consist of artists with MFAs from certain schools, for instance. And that's never really been something that I've put too much emphasis or weight on, you know. And I think the artists that I was always attracted to possessed qualities that were probably less tangible than these sort of certificates and stuff, like these, like actually like more legitimate and institutional credentials, you know, allow for. So what we try to advocate is artists who fall out of that category. You know, there's a couple of artists that we work with that I'm not even sure if they finished high school, but in any other realm they might even be considered an outsider artist, but you know, I there's really no hierarchy that here with regard to education. The other thing that we really advocate is artists that have very multidisciplinary practices that feed into one another. This last Whitney Biennial, the hypothesis was that, you know, the paradigm right now is very much that artists are using these very democratized tools like being able to upload video and just using sort of tools that like fall outside of the realms of sculpture and painting, and are pursuing more integrated arts. And I feel like almost every artist that we work with really goes back and forth between mediums and stuff, and so which it makes it very exciting for us, because from one show to the next, we don't know if Agat Snow, for instance, is going to be showing paper mache mobile sculptures or presenting a video that incorporates a performance that she conjures up. So that's another thing that we try to stand for. A third thing is trying to fight this this ageist sort of situation that seems to play too, in my opinion, seems to play too big of a role in the art field.
Such as what?
Well, it's the flavor of the last 10-15 years has very much been, you know, really it's really embraced like artist just out of the starting gate in one way or another, you know, right out of an MFA program, right from the white columns, like sort of back room, you know, like these, I'm also kind of speaking more specifically to my generation, I guess. And if you don't make it by the time you're 35, you're washed up, sort of thing. And I feel like that's something that's really unfortunate and totally just counterproductive and wrong. You know, most artists right out of school, like, you know, after 5 or 10 years, who knows if they're even going to be making art anymore. And so as often as possible, we try to incorporate mid-career to more established artists as well, because we feel like it really creates a very strong balance in our program and adds more girth to what we do.
Do you think that, I mean, similar to this kind of this fascination or fetishization of this brand new, you know, artist, like, you know, the budding flower, if you will, you know, you're talking about artists, you know, who show, such as Deitch Projects, people like that, you know, that show people who are 21, 22, 23, who just got their MFA or just about to get their MFA, more like it. Do you think that kind of plays into America's, I would say, you know, love or kind of an enamored perspective of, you know, kind of that nubile young girl of, like, you know, how in magazines today, if you go to Vogue or Elle or something like that, that many of the women in it, almost all of the women in it, look like 12-year-old boys, you know, as far as, you know, shape-wise and physicality and things like that. Do you think that's a similar kind of line that can be drawn through American, you know, collecting as well right now, is that, you know, it has to be young and fresh and beautiful and not tainted at all and not world-weary, you know? What do you think about that?
Well, sure, and even if it's not in the physicality of the artist, it's in the sort of physicality of the work, you know? There's artworks out there that I was convinced were made by, like, 23-year-olds that are being made by 40 or 50 years old because they're probably trying to make work that looks young, you know? And so I feel like it's very much an American paradigm. It's also a European paradigm too, and but yeah, I think that's a good analogy, you know. I bet that you know, that fascination is probably goes hand in hand with a whole host of other sort of ideologies that you know, consumer ideology and political ideology, etc., that that is much more of a paradigm that's kind of on its way out. I don't know if I'm expressing what I'm thinking about very eloquently.
No, definitely. I mean, you take a look at, you know, and I'm not going to say that Damien Hirst is kind of the newer flavor, because he's definitely, you know, he's definitely been in the game for quite a while now. But even, you know, what Christie's has their auction this week, their post-contemporary auction, and, in, you know, taking a look at it this morning, even Damien Hirst, who's spinning paintings, you know, were going for millions of dollars, you know, even 6 months ago, are now down at, like, $150,000, $250,000, and that, I think, could be argued that the kind of the economic collapse that's happening right now is really bringing back kind of an older, more solid art scene versus, like, a young, flash in the pan, like, you know, flavor of the month style. What do you think about that?
Yeah, well, I definitely agree that's possible. That's hopefully the case. Maybe it's no coincidence that I open my gallery now and I for some one reason or another couldn't previously, maybe that wasn't the right time for me, I feel like there's a much more symbiotic thing happening between me and my peers and the public, and a lot of the art that I'm introducing, quite a bit of it probably would have been thoroughly rejected, frankly, like 5-10 years ago. So, yeah, I guess there is this sort of timing thing and this coincidence thing. And, I have to say, talking about it, that our show in September, which opened on September 9th, it was a solo exhibition by Agathe Snow, entitled Just Say Yes. And her whole thesis was that that America is about to enter this this neo-Renaissance, that there is a whole new wave coming through. And she made these papier-mâché sculptures, extremely fragile materials, and what she made with the papier-mâché sculptures, a few of the sculptures incorporated Jeff Koons, sort of like tight, like these stainless steel sculpture images, like his bunnies, and she made a truck out of papier-mâché, and her whole thing was like, Koons is all about these rugged and permanent and forever materials and masculine materials. What I'm going to do is make it the opposite way. I'm going to make it the opposite way that Koons would. And she brought a feminist and a sort of a completely different sort of ideological sort of approach to materials. And so the show opened on September 9th. Lehman Brothers collapsed on September 14th. This was a show that, not to sound too sure of myself, but we basically had a sold out show in the bag, and because of the economic situation, not a thing sold from the show. And, a couple of consecutive months without sales for us is extremely dangerous. If we go for more than 2 or 3 months without sales, we're going to close, basically. Like, that's our situation. So, it was a really, really down period for us, and a very intense show. And, but it's interesting because Agathe's statement, was kind of prophetic in a way, she almost kind of saw this coming. And of course, after months go by, the one sale that we actually managed to make from that show eventually, in 2007 or 2008, was to the Guggenheim Museum. One of those papier-mâché sculptures is in their permanent collection now. And subsequently, because of that, and also because time has passed, we've managed to place all of the works. And it's just kind of, people are especially responsive to sort of the kind of visual and conceptual nature of that series in particular, because maybe those ideas are resonating more now, given the economic and political climate and stuff. So there was a look of sort of detritus and sort of like an end or negative side to like a consumerist sort of like world, but there was also something hopeful about it. So I guess that's the kind of thing that these, when the stars are aligned like that, when there's disappointments that we can kind of like get through and work out and stuff, and when I can have that sort of dialogue with an artist and share that and stuff, this is the kind of thing that keeps me going and makes me feel like I'm doing the right thing, you know? But yeah, I do feel like work has to, I mean, the other thing that I guess we advocate is for work to actually be reflective or responsive to what's happening in the world, you know, like,
and as the world goes to hell, so does the art.
Yeah. And so that's probably another sort of undercurrent to what we do. And then, you know, there's many undercurrents. There's many things that kind of influence what we do and what we show. I would say another thing that we try to put out there is a humane voice. The show that we have on right now by Sebastian Bremer, it's a portrait, but it's a very autobiographical portrait. It took him over 3 years to make this one piece and stuff. And so there's a real seriousness, there's a real love, there's a real again, humane quality, I guess, to the work that I've always responded to, but I'm probably responding to it even more, like, lately.
Well, that sounds good. Thank you so much. My name is Zephyr Thrall. You're listening to Frank Prattle. You're probably listening to Art International Radio at www.artonair.org, or possibly, you know, it's possible, one in a million, you're listening to frankprattle.com or somewhere out on the radio airwaves as well. My special guest today, James Fuentes of James Fuentes LLC. Thank you so much.
Thank you.